The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Well, welcome back. As we head into hour two, it is a delight to have our dear friend Pete Peterson with us. He is the dean at the Pepperdine School of Public Policy. I'll just tell you how good it is, the Pepperdine School. You look at what he's doing and what some of the conferences and speeches is and speakers he's bringing in to Pepperdine on his Twitter feed, which is at Pete4CA, and it makes me want to go back to school. Well, his school, your school, Pete. How are you, sir? Happy Friday.
And to you, Seth. Great to be back with you.
Heck of a week of serious things that really have me worried. But before we go down those depressive areas, at least depressive for me, give us a little lift. This looks really interesting, a speech you folks hosted with Josh Mitchell. Was this part of your Tocqueville program? Tell me what we're doing over it, what this was about. This looks really good. America's Current Political Culture from Josh Mitchell.
Yeah, so this is part of an initiative here, which we've discussed before, our new Ed Meese Institute for Liberty and the American Project, which has been an effort to look at national policy, but really through the lens of political culture. Mm-hmm. And in that, Josh Mitchell, a professor at Georgetown, author of several books, and known to be one of America's foremost experts on Alexis de Tocqueville, gave the keynote at a conference that the Meese Institute hosted here a few weeks ago. And it was a really powerful speech, not to give it away, because I think it's important for all of us to watch and take in. But essentially, he was making a point that's been made in other places, that once a culture becomes increasingly secularized, it's not as if the formal institutions of religion are completely lost. They simply morph, if you will, into other systems of faith. And for Mitchell, what this means is much of the identity politics that we're seeing, certainly in part based on the history and reality of critical theory, is in fact a type of religion. I mean, this is something that John McWhorter talks about in many of his articles and recent book on the subject. And Josh Mitchell is essentially making the same point, that as a culture, in this case the American culture, becomes more secular, it doesn't become less religious. The religious devotions just change into more material and ideological ones.
It's interesting. So the point, if I'm picking this up correctly, Pete, is that there's something about the human condition that demands of itself and of its individuals a belief in something, a faith in something. And if I hear it right, it can be God, or it can be what we traditionally think of as God. But if it isn't, it's going to be something else. They're going to replace God with a belief in something else.
That's right. And again, in particular, what Josh is arguing, just given his perspective on America's current political culture, is that those religious devotions have shifted to ideological ones, and specifically in this area around what might be called identity politics and views of American history. I mean, these are all part and parcel of a larger set of religious beliefs.
I see the connection to what McMorter's saying now that you're mentioning. Yes, because in his most recent book, he kind of calls it a church, the belief in this racial, this racial shell game. He calls it, is that the right phrase? I don't know what the right phrase is. The racialization and the re-racialization of America is like talking to a woke church when you argue.
Yeah. Which is, again, is McWhorter's perspective on this, is that there's a certain religious devotion, a certain amount of faith in these principles. And again, what Josh is calling out is that if we are disordering our religious beliefs and affiliations, that's bound to have a negative impact on the broader American culture. And it just was a very...
Do you see this with the environmental movement, by the way, a little bit, too?
He does.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that's part and parcel of this as well. Anything that has a certain kind of a religious fervor that is not, in fact, a faith tradition, mm-hmm. is what he's calling out there.
You know what's interesting to me about that, and you know, I don't mean to be crude here, Pete. What's interesting to me is before you joined us on this show today, I played a broadcast from 1965 of Paul Harvey, and it was titled "If I Were the Devil," and it's 3.5 minutes of describing in 1965 what we are having almost every sentence here today. And he gets to a part in his 3.5 minutes, "If I Were the Devil," he talks about the churches. He said, "In God's own churches, I would substitute psychology for religion, and I would deify science." Now, before I ask you to comment on that, let me add to that to one of my favorite sermons by Martin Luther King, which is titled A Knock at Midnight, where he says the bestsellers in psychology today are Man Against Himself, the neurotic personality of our time, and Modern Man in Search of a Soul. And you can find those books sold at almost every church in America. Anyway, you can comment.
Yeah, well, what he's in part getting at there is the difference between science as a process used in pursuit of the truth, to scientism, which is a view that if something can be seen as being derived or called out by science, often rarely used, but really should be with a capital S, the way that certain people are making proclamations supposedly in the name of science, then there really should be no debate or dispute about that. And obviously, we've seen some of that in the response to COVID, where we were told that science says X. Well, science doesn't say anything. The scientific method may reveal certain truths that we have to consider. But the way that term is thrown about in America's political culture is one in which it's really intended to shut down any debate or discussion.
How do you think stands faith in America today? Last time we visited, we talked a lot about Tocqueville and your Prager University discussion on democracy in America. And you'll get it right, and I'll butcher it a little bit, but in Democracy in America, Tocqueville does say that faith or church religion, I think he says, religion is really the first of our political institutions. Throw that all together. How do you think the faith tradition and faith in religion stands in America today?
Well, I think it's what we're seeing in the data, that trend lines that were not encouraging as far as religious participation before COVID have only gotten worse. If we're to understand religious devotion as actual participation or philanthropy or participating in faith-based nonprofits, while America continues to lead the world and be importantly unique in that sense, certainly in the Western world, we are seeing a decline in all those measures of religious devotion. And as Tocqueville pointed out, that could be a sign in the future that at once was America's strength, this ability to combine religious devotion with devotion to the neighbor, and in so doing, remove the necessity of government to be so integrally involved in our lives. You know, back to that Dennis Prager line, the bigger the government, the smaller the citizen, and vice versa. But it's fair to say that that is something that we need to be very concerned about. that with declines in religious participation, are we going to see what I call the part of the Tocqueville prophecy, which is that once that begins to happen, you begin to see Americans requesting the government be more involved in finding so-called solutions to social challenges.
It might be too strong a phraseology, but I had a guest in here the other day from Washington who was talking about that very issue of we don't really see nuns anymore on our streets or in our schools or in our hospitals. Not many, not like we used to when we were growing up.
Yep.
He said, but we do see an awful lot of nuns who have married the government. That is there.
Yeah.
That. Let me take a quick commercial break. I want to come back to you on a bunch of stuff that kind of gets us into maybe what we're seeing as some of the downwash effects of what we're describing. Pete Peterson and I will be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Delighted to have Pete Peterson with us. He is the dean at the Pepperdine School of Public Policy, publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. We talk about some of the problems, a lot of the problems in a lot of our institutions of higher education. Pepperdine is the solution if you're looking for graduate work in trying to make our communities better. Pete, speaking of, two stories out of California I've been talking about, and I don't know if you know a professor up at Stanford named Keith Humphreys. He's in the medical school, and he does psychiatry and behavioral sciences. I'm going to have him on a little later talking about the drug issue in America, the overdose, the poisonings in this country, and maybe a sad sign of some of the decline in faith, not only in God, but in our fellow man. Two stories out of California. One up in San Francisco, where a 10-month-old baby was rushed to the hospital from a fentanyl overdose. A 10-month-old was given Narcan, believe it or not,
yeah.
You know, to reverse a fentanyl overdose. The kid did not voluntarily initiate the use of fentanyl. He got a little pill from, you know, the grounds in San Francisco in which he and his babysitter were walking. Thank God he lived. I'm seeing a story out of the San Fernando Valley where 10 students at a middle school there were rushed to the hospital from marijuana overdoses. These young kids, and I mean, you know, high school students and 10-month-olds, Pete, it is so sad. We have We have an area that looks a little bit like some of these places in the Tenderloin in San Francisco. We have an area here called the Zone. And 3 weeks ago, a 24-week born-alive infant was found dead in the Zone, burned to death. What are we doing to ourselves, man? We're losing something here. We're losing something more than – it may start with the churches. We're losing something big, and it's not getting better quick.
Yeah, and of course we've talked about some of these cultural issues, especially the ones related to deaths of despair, loneliness, alienation.
Yeah.
But in some ways, Seth, you know, we can just go back to the beginning of our conversation.
I was thinking you would. I was hoping you would. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, what are the signs of an increasingly secularized culture that at once used to be? Used to have a greater culturally religious devotion. And of course, what's important to understand about this, I heard a recent interview with a podcast interview with the historian Neil Ferguson, who's at the Hoover Institution in Stanford. And it was a very personal interview. I know Neil a little, Dr. Ferguson a little bit. We've had him speak down here before. And so the interview goes starts going into the area of faith, and the podcaster wasn't actually a Christian, so this was made it doubly interesting. And it was a very innocent question about where Neil's faith was and his faith walk and how he was passing that on to his kids. And he was very open about the fact that he thought it was very important for the kids to be exposed to the Christian faith. And while he himself had not become a believer, he understood both personally but also historically how important it was for a society to hold on to these faiths and this faith and these positions. Mm. Because as he said, every evidence we have of a fully secularized culture, those tend to be the most brutal.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And of course, he called out the history of the communist regimes, who were atheistic, militantly atheistic regimes. And so as we think about what the trend lines are here in America, I hate to say it, but we almost shouldn't be surprised, I guess, in some ways.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we should be diligent about making the connection between these stories, which are so horrifying, and under and situating them within some broader trends, and to understand that there is a part of, back to Tocqueville again, there's a part of the Christian nature, certainly within America, that has these incredible political benefits, both in society, but also personally.
I think that's well stated. I often run straight to C.S. Lewis's line in Men Without Chests, that it seems like we've reached a point where we're demanding the function, but we've removed the organ.
Yeah.
And the organ, of course, is faith in God, and we're expecting people to be men and women of virtue and enterprise, and you cannot do it. The role of the church has been fundamental to almost every great social reform in this country. Manumission, of course, civil rights, of course, suffrage rights, of course. I'd like to see it, become instrumental again in the things that, if we're talking about some of this chronic homeless stuff, if we're talking about family formation, that's another big part of this, Pete. I don't remember if I saw it from something Brad Wilcox did or somewhere. Maybe he retweeted it out. Not only family formation in decline, but the incredible rise of never married women and the incredible rise of women who are not having children. These are all signs. At least I think to the sane and sober, they're signs of failure.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, we're talking about human nature here, right? Which desires affiliation, and no one better than C.S. Lewis to be just so clear on the fact that we desire to worship. We were made for worship, one might say. And this goes back to the earlier part of the discussion, which asked the question, well, if it's not going to be one of the traditional faiths that becomes our object of devotion, if you will, does that mean that we just simply turn that part of our humanity off, or do we redirect it to other things? And of course, as much as the communist regimes were atheistic, they really had significant faith, objects of faith.
Yes, yes.
You read Marx and you read the end goal of the, essentially, the communist project. It is a strong message on earth.
Strong message. And I think children particularly want a strong message. We've probably discussed before. I mean, it may be a little too black and white, a little too Manichaean, but I think children naturally want something to march for. They'll either join the Crips and the Bloods, or they'll join the Boy Scouts. And when it comes to religion, they'll either join the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, or something else. We can be as gods, Whitaker Chambers said, was man's second oldest faith. And that's really what the communist project was. Let me take a quick break, Pete. This is great going into the holiday season. Pete Peterson and I will be right back. He is the dean at the Pepperdine School of Public Policy, publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Pete Peterson is our guest. He is the dean at the Pepperdine School of Public Policy. Pete, speaking about the Marxist notion, religion being the poison of the masses, and that sort of thing, Apple is much in the news this week because of its involvement with China. I don't know if you saw this really very haunting moment where a Fox Business reporter was asking Tim Cook, the head of Apple, while he was walking through the hall. You saw this. She asked him three simple questions. The first one, every American should be able to answer without, you know, having to give it a moment's thought. She said, "Do you support the protesters in China?" He stayed as silent as silent could be, just blithely walking by her to that really question. No one should have a moment's hesitance in answering. So I think while that's going on, we saw what he was doing with not allowing AirDrop to be used by the protesters, and which is a way they communicate without surveillance over there. At the behest of the CCP, he did that, of course, Apple did. You know, there's one thing about condemning China, and the other worry I have, which is us kind of importing and accepting many of those noxious doctrines here, or at least becoming comfortable with them. Am I making a little bit of sense?
Yeah, I mean, again, we're seeing this in how there was also another interview with Tim Cook. He's had a very bad week in the media week.
Yeah.
There was another Fox News reporter that actually forced him to answer some questions as to some of at least what's being rumored about the possibility that Twitter would be kicked off the Apple App Store, while at the same time TikTok is there's not a debate that that's ever going to be kicked off the App Store. And so these kinds of
That's a great point. There will not be an internal debate about that. Go ahead.
Well, and it goes to this other piece, right, which Apple, as with so many companies, if you're going to engage in this kind of moralizing of so much of what's going on in the country, whether it's, say, Major League Baseball.
Yeah, or Nike, or Colin Kaepernick.
Atlanta, or
that,
Nike,
right, yeah,
or Salesforce, right. I mean, you name the company. Mm-hmm. Then when are you going to be held accountable as a Fortune 100 company for the very real decisions that you're making vis-a-vis China? You know, it reminds me of we had Victor Davis Hanson give our dean's lecture this past spring, and at the end of the lecture, it was on his book, The Dying Citizen. I asked him if he thought that China might be the existential threat to wokeism. In other words, could the realization that China both depends on a woke American culture, but also at the same time exposes the hypocrisy of so many who are operating under that framework, i.e. Fortune 100 companies, could that be the realization? And we've seen it this week just with Tim Cook and the way that, you know, he's been asked these questions.
In a weird way, half of the country, or maybe half of the country, kind of got there by accident. In a weird way.
Yeah.
With the Republican Party. Do you remember, you and I are roughly the same age, do you remember growing up seeing bumper stickers like "people, not profits"? The left used to, you know, hate the American corporation. And so I guess what they did is took it over, I guess.
Yeah.
And now it's conservatives who talk about, you know, you mentioned Prager talking about the bigger the government, the smaller the citizen. But he will go on and say, "I hate big anything, including big business." And, you know, I mean, he's obviously sweeping with a deliberately broad brush, but that's the point he's driving at in some respects. And I think a lot of conservatives, a lot of Republicans now buy into that in a weird reversal of roles.
No, I think that's fair to say. It again goes to this realization that these companies, which really are seeking to engage in what might be called social issues, certainly in legislation, even at the state level, Are they going to hold themselves accountable to some of these issues? Those particular questions asked by that Fox News reporter you mentioned when he was walking through the Hill, I mean, were just very legitimate questions that he really should answer.
Do you support Chinese protests? Well, damn it, they support protests here. They'll either they'll even misname them as peaceful if they're violent to get them to support them. But of course, they were supporting them under a Marxist banner, which is kind of an interesting thought too. Let me take a quick commercial break and do one last segment for you. I know we only have a few minutes left with you, but I want to talk about another bad week of news for someone when we do come right back. Pete Peterson and I'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Pete Peterson has been our guest. Pete, I know you have to run any moment now, so you just let me know when you have to go and we'll not worry about it, but I want to thank you for your time. I did want, if I could, at least get a sentence from you. Something odd, not remarked about enough with the Kanye West meltdowns, not just the anti-Semitism, and I don't want to dismiss it, and I haven't, and I wouldn't, but also this inability to see what many people evidently do want to see, which is a public mental health breakdown in real time. Ooh. and it's a sad part of our society too, isn't it?
It is. I had heard it. Apparently, he's been taken off the Twitter platform.
Yes.
And I saw somebody on that platform remark that Elon was actually doing Kanye, or Ye, as I guess he's known now, a favor.
Probably.
Yeah. But that is, it's a very disturbing thing to watch. And one would hope, as we should for anyone, that people get the help they need, especially in instances like this, especially with people, I dare say, who are so influential. This could be, as someone who believes in such things, a redemption story if he makes certain decisions and seeks to redeem what has obviously been a pretty disturbing couple weeks.
And there's also this line too, a fine line, but a line, where we don't want to excuse the volitional things that he is saying, the bigoted, bigoted things. We don't want to whitewash those with a diagnosis of mental illness. But for someone to continue to go down this path, both things are increasingly true: the mental decline, the mental health decline, and the levels of hell he keeps bringing to the surface with regard to bigotry. And both things are happening at the same time, it seems to me.
Right, and to call out those anti-Semitic remarks and related remarks for what they are, whatever their inspiration, they need to be condemned and not excused.
Yeah, it may be the first obvious time we can say this person is a danger to himself and others. It might actually be the first time we fit. I know you have to run, Pete. I appreciate you so much, and I thank you so much for everything you're doing with our young minds in this country.
Always great to be with you, Seth.
Thank you, sir. Pete Peterson from the Pepperdine School of Public Policy, publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.